89.5 FM, and I'm Phil Taylor, and we're going to be spending the program today talking about a great labor leader and an outstanding human being, a great class fighter, and every other encomium you could think to add to his name, Peter Liebovitz. Peter Liebovitz has died. The illness was aggressive and sudden, we're going to be talking with Jacob Liebovitz, who you will know as one of our co-hosts often, and certainly I consider Jay a co-producer. People wonder, you know, how those who like us say, how do you do that? And we have a lot of good producers, and Jacob sees to it we get good guests. As a matter of fact, my last time talking to you, Jacob, was where you were participating with us, was that there was the G20 demonstrations. Your father participated, and both of you were on the line for CIUT, and you linked us up with the Ontario Federation of Labor President, Sid Ryan, which couldn't have been better from the station's point of view. And by the way, we were sharing that with the U.S. program Now, Democracy Now, Amy Goodman, and she was very impressed with that. So, and of course, your father was there. If you don't mind, Jacob, we better bring people up to date. For some, they're just learning of this. Peter Liebovitz, who was with the steelworkers and very active in the NDP in the community, what's the story of his health? How did this come about?
Yeah, he was he got sick, but not seriously sick, about 3 weeks ago. Went to his family doctor and was diagnosed with a small infection, and was on a course of antibiotics to deal with that infection. About a week and a half after he started that treatment, he realized he wasn't feeling better, and so he went back to the doctor and they gave him a blood test. Hmm. And that blood test showed that he had a fairly high white blood cell count, which concerned the doctor, and the doctor asked him to head immediately to the hospital to get it checked out. So we went to the hospital with him last Thursday, and as soon as he arrived in the hospital, they confirmed that his white blood cell count was high, indicated to him that he had a form of blood cancer. Hmm. And within 24 hours, and after a bone marrow sample, they were able to diagnose him with a form of blood cancer that's quite rare, very rare. They say only 1% of the time folks get this form of it. The name of it was T prolymphocytic leukemia, and it was an aggressive form of cancer. So the doctors immediately started a treatment. Unfortunately, there is only one treatment for this disease, so there was a sort of one-shot chance at this, and over the course of the weekend, they tried their best with the drug, but unfortunately, it didn't do what it was supposed to do, and he quickly deteriorated until he passed away very early Saturday morning.
Saturday the was it 18th? Was it 18th?
Saturday the 18th. That's right.
Yeah. By the way, we're marking this already. The response is quite overwhelming. As a matter of fact, we're going to be talking in short with a dear friend of Peter's, Mike Hirsch, and Phil Conlon is, of course, here with us, a regular part of our team. And all of us know Peter. And we are not surprised, but I think we're kind of overwhelmed by how many voices have begun already to talk about what a remarkable individual. You're receiving most of these things. I may as well ask you, Jacob, if you could tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, just to set it up a little bit, as soon as he got sick and we realized it was to the degree of danger that it was, we wanted to communicate with the folks that he works with and that he has his life with. So it's, our understanding is not just his family that's close to him, but the people that he works with and, you know, all the different projects that he's working on are also very close to him. And what struck me right away was the amount of people who said to me, "We knew something was wrong when your father didn't call us back within an hour or two." So, when a day went by and he wasn't returning, phone calls, people knew something was wrong, and so we tried as best we could and under the circumstances to let people know that he was sick, and then eventually we had to let people know that he passed away. And so there's been a huge response out there, and I'm sure I'm not aware of most of it, because I'm getting a few notes, folks that knew the family or knew me, but we're getting emails and phone calls from really all over the world. We just received a really beautiful note from a family friend and colleague and activist in London, England. Have been receiving notices from folks from as far away as Venezuela, where he was recently at the World Social Forum, and folks got to know him there.
And by the way, if I could just drink, not only was he there and he met so many people and worked with them, but he also uncovered old friends like Walter Riley, a lawyer from Oakland, California, whose son is Boots Riley, of the coup. And after this shows the someone who is committed to an outlook and a struggle. They hadn't seen each other for 20 years, so Walter Riley and Peter Leavitt shook hands in Caracas, and as though it was only yesterday that they hadn't been talking.
Right. Just an incredible. He had an incredible influence over so many people. So the notes are not just from folks that have been working with him recently, but people who knew him, 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, who remember him as being the remarkable political figure that he is.
Mm-hmm. Well, and one of those friends who knew him from 40 years ago is sitting at my right, Michael Hirsch. Mike, many people say this about Peter. It's kind of like they don't quite understand themselves. One, they don't, of course, want to believe this has happened. But they also are saying to themselves, how come this guy had such impact? Why am I so concerned? What he was doing? Because he wasn't a loud person, and he wasn't an aggressive person. He wasn't that was not his style at all. But now you know him from the time you were late teens. That's saying something. Talk about him. What do you remember?
Well, I met Peter in 19. I wasn't sure whether it was 67 or 68, but Roberto San Vicente, a fellow friend and comrade, says it was 1968, so I'll go with him. But I really didn't get to know Peter well. And we had met actually through our girlfriends at the time, Theo and Sandy, who was Jake's mother. And Sandy and Theo and Peter were going to Sir George, which is now Concordia. And
Were you at, I'm sorry, you were at Concordia?
I was at McGill.
You were at McGill.
And we had our own political things going on. We had heard from our girlfriends of each other, and we were dying to meet each other, which we did.
Cherchez la femme.
Yeah.
All right.
And but we really got to know each other at the Sir George computer riots, or whatever it's referred to.
Yeah, one of the most celebrated incidents in university history in Canada. One of the great episodes, which would be it's already in the history books and be talked about many times over.
And people forget what it was about. It was about racism. It was about a professor of biology, who I think was Adamson. And he was failing all the black students. Just happened, coincidentally. And so the black students took action against that. They took over the seventh floor of Sir George on Maisonneuve. And the whites wanted to show support, and so the whites had the ninth floor. And it was during that, at the time at McGill, we had occupied the political science department, so we had our own things going on.
Mm-hmm.
But we took time from our busy schedules and met and talked all night, actually, one night, and where I got to know Peter really well.
Just to say, by the way, people should understand that this was a period of student upheaval around the
big
world.
Big time, to say the least.
And,
we're talking about the 60s here.
Yes.
So Peter and I talked all night, and and I, it just happened at the time that I was organizing a union at for the cafeteria workers and library workers at McGill into the CSN, not the steelworkers. To those steelworkers listening, I'm sorry about this.
Well, yeah.
And Peter was and he was telling me about his experience. He'd worked at INCO up in Sudbury, and
while a student.
Yeah, well, he'd worked in the summer and was very proud of being a steelworker and being a miner, and he it gave him a taste of unionism, and we both agreed at that moment that that's what we wanted to do in our lives. We wanted to be union activists. We wanted to be organizers. We wanted to be leaders of the union, and we used the term.
Assuming you could earn it. By the way, this is
by
a voice.
By the way, it was a tough battle. It wasn't easy. None of that stuff turned out to be easy.
The voice of Michael Hirsch, and we are discussing Peter Leavitt, a great labor leader and activist who died this past Saturday. So, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
But we actually used the term "working class heroes," the John Lennon song. We wanted to be working class heroes, and we were kids. I mean, I think it's better than wanting to be a multi-billionaire.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And so that was
someone who would say greed is good. No, you didn't believe that.
No, we didn't believe greed was any good at all, actually. And so we took the other road, and we decided we were going to be union leaders. And our lives were intertwined from that moment to this, really, including our kids grew up together. I mean, but it all started in Montreal.
Yeah. Well, give us, by the way, a physical impression. I have one. Well, maybe we could share. Met him at a conference, and now this is mysterious to me because when you have to recall years ago, you can think you're talking about one conference and you're actually talking about three. But my memory is that it was an anti-Vietnam conference of very high order in the sense that a lot of people were there, including a gentleman from Chile called Salvador Allende, and who was trying to become president of Chile, and of course he did, and then Henry Kissinger had him killed. But he was there. There was also, I remember, a struggle to get him there. But I see Phil Connors' eyes have just lit up, so I know we're going to get all the details of it.
November 68.
Yeah.
And it was a very big snowstorm, I remember that. And I remember that we met a delegation from China. And that was really exciting because, of course, for those of us who just...
Oh, that shows you what kind of conference
it
was.
That's right, yeah.
I mean, there's people from... There were Vietnamese present.
Yes, there was. There were representatives of the government of the of what we called North Vietnam, and there were also representatives of the National Liberation Front from the part of the Vietnam which was under U.S. occupation.
So it was, and that was really the core of what we were all talking about. I have a... impression. I was a part of a group. We were trying to organize solidarity with those who were resisting the U.S. invasion, occupation of their country. And so we formed, of course, as you would, caucuses. Anytime you're at a meeting of thousands, there are caucuses. So we were, and my best memory is that I had been there and spoken at at this caucus. And then I see this young man, a slender fellow with Sandy, who became his wife, and I have the distinct impression that they look just like the cover of Bob Dylan's first album. if you know that one of Dylan with going down the street in the cold with his shoulders against the cold and a young woman with him, that was my physical impression. The other, of course, immediate sensation that I had from shaking hands with him was that he was a totally sincere person. I mean, I didn't need any, I didn't need 10 minutes, a half an hour, an hour, but that's what I noticed. And, we'll ask Mike to elaborate again on that. Now, the Sir George thing, what other kinds of actions? I think I asked you earlier today, our listeners have to hear this odd expression, Miguel Francais.
Miguel Francais was, Miguel was the bastion of the English control of Quebec, really.
So you decided to turn into a French university?
Well, we tried. It didn't really work out that way, but we tried to turn it into a French school. And actually, that was Stan Gray that was leading that at and the Socialist Action caucus or committee, I can't remember, and which I was a part of as well. And Stan Gray led that fight. But that was very popular. That was a very popular thing as well.
Tell the numbers. You had a demonstration.
We had a demonstration of, there was so many Quebec knew how to hold a demonstration.
They still do.
We were at CEGEP demonstration.
Maybe we ought to just say Peter's a Quebecer.
25,000 people, you know. I mean, no joke. And that was in the late 60s, early 70s. So these demonstrations, both from McGill Francais and the CEGEP, were 20, 30,000 people.
Phenomenal. That's the voice of Mike Hirsch. He's with the United Steelworkers, quite a well-known, prominent leader of the steelworkers and a very active OFL-CLC, and a sergeant with many stripes. With us is Jacob Leavitt, son of Peter, and a fellow broadcaster with us. And by the way, Peter was a big proponent of alternative radio, since we are inundated continually by people who just buy things, including information and ideas. And we have our alternative radio, the best answer. Peter had a program in Hamilton at McMaster University. Could you identify that? By the way, tell us about that show.
Yeah, it's I guess it's a sister station to CIUT called CFMU, run out of McMaster University. And their show is every Wednesday. I can't remember the time that it begins, but it's Wednesday evenings, and it's called Unusual Sources.
A great name, by the way. Yeah. I mean, I called this the Taylor Report, so I wouldn't forget the name of the show, but that was original and creative name, right. Unusual Sources. Now, we're also going to be joined here shortly by David Jacobs, who has worked as counsel for the various unions and worked very closely with Peter. But while we're getting David Jacobs, Jacob, can you tell us, there's going to be a celebration of Peter's life, a commemoration, however you want to title it. You want to tell us about that?
I think we really want to give everyone a chance to come out and be together while we remember my dad and talk about talk about all the things that he's done over the years and really try and honor his life's work as much as we can in a couple of hours. So the details of that, and I'll look at my BlackBerry while I'm talking, it's going to be on Sunday at 1 o'clock. We're going to have a period of time at the beginning where folks can come and meet the family and sign the guest book, and then later in the program we'll have some speeches from folks that have worked closely with him. And, you know, as we sort of try and figure that piece out, we realize there's hardly anyone in our movement here in Canada that hasn't worked with him closely, and so it's been kind of a interesting process just to go through that list. But I will get the address for you momentarily.
I think we're joined now by David Jacobs. Are you there, David?
I am. I'm here.
Actually, I was hearing just a third thing in my ear, and I thought, well, that doesn't sound like David, but. I don't understand technology. David, thank you very much for joining us. People should know you have been a labor lawyer for many years and considerable distinction, and you have worked very closely with several unions, and you had occasion to work with Peter Leavitt, recently deceased, of the United Steelworkers in many causes. Okay. We have in the studio, by the way, friends that you would know, Michael Hirsch, Phil Conlon, and, of course, Jacob Leavitt. I just ask you, what's your memories? What comes to mind when you think of your friend Peter?
I'm terribly sorry. I'm getting a loud noise on the line, so I'm not hearing you anymore. So.
Sabotage. You don't hear at all. Okay, we'll try to reach him again. And the information I have about Sunday is that it's at Stony Creek at the LIUNA Hall, and that's at 526 Winona, right?
That's right, yeah.
526 Winona Road North, and it's going to be 1 p.m., and the feeling we all get is there's going to be hundreds of people.
Yeah, no, without...
And we want too many people. That's what we want. We want there to be too many people. Please come. There's nothing wrong with a great crowd of people sharing, who share values and appreciation of courage and a singular political talent, which your father embodied. I can tell you, I mean, it's the absence that makes you, unfortunately, the absence makes you say, oh, no, wait a minute, now we're missing this, and nobody else knows how to fly that. Or if we have this kind of problem, who would be the one? And Peter was gifted in that respect. Can do many things. David, are you there?
I'm here. I'm sorry about that before.
That's quite all right. Let's practice a bit. So you hear me okay?
I do hear you perfectly now.
All right. Well, I've already warned you that there are many dear friends of yours in the room, so you go right ahead. We're going to ask you, first of all, as a labor lawyer, what is your memory of Peter Leibovitz, your first memory, first thoughts?
Well, firstly, I want to say it's a privilege to be asked to come on here and talk about Peter. It's an incredible loss for the union movement and loss of a good friend. I've known Peter and worked with him as a friend and labor lawyer for 30 years or more. But I think, when I was reading on Facebook, people talked about Peter as a guy with courage, and he was a guy with tremendous courage, and I think his courage gave everybody around him courage, you know. He and his brothers and sisters and the steelworkers, and particularly when the executive of Local 8782, the Lake Erie works of what was then Stelco, now U.S. Steel, did some of the bravest things imaginable in fighting for the rights of workers there. So, I mean, my strongest recollections are that we went through a number of battles over all sorts of things, contracting out of work and this, that, and the other. But one of the biggest battles, of course, was when Stelco declared bankruptcy, and the union was furious and saw the Stelco's declaring bankruptcy as being an attempt to attack the union, the rights of workers, and particularly to take away their pension, the pension rights, and the union waged an absolutely heroic 2-year struggle.
Yeah, by the way, people, again, just underlining the significance of Peter Leibovitz and his role, you're talking about a moment that hit the headlines across Canada and North America when Stelco said we're bankrupt. What a moment. Please continue.
No, absolutely. And let me say, not only was it a huge moment for the labor movement, I think it proved all kinds of things about the power of organized labor, but it changed the face of labor law. I mean, there's now a chapter in one of the leading law texts, I was going to say labor law, but one of the leading bankruptcy law texts is called Bankruptcy Law After Stelco. So Pete was really changed the face of bankruptcy law. And just to go back to my point about Pete's tremendous courage and how he gave courage to those around him. I mean, I don't know if people know this story, but at the very, very beginning of the case, when Stelco had just declared bankruptcy and the union was going to challenge that declaration of bankruptcy and say that, Stelco is claiming to be bankrupt at a time when we think it's going to make money hand over fist. And Stelco was saying, no, we're going to run out of money shortly. We in the union turned out to be completely right. I mean, Stelco made more money in the first year of a bankruptcy than it had made in many years previously. But at the beginning, the judge, who later became a friend, he gave a speech which I assume judges give at the beginning of bankruptcy proceedings, where he said, we're all in the same boat. We all have to compromise. Words to that effect and so on. And I was trying to consider, how do I respond to this? Because we were about to get up and challenge the bankruptcy, which I thought wasn't going to be a very popular thing with the court at that point in time. So I went out and spoke to Pete and said, I'm thinking I should respond to this with something conciliatory. I should start off and say, Your Honor, I've heard you. And Pete interrupted me and said, if you're going to go down that road, David, the next thing you've got to say is, and you're wrong. And at that point in time, I thought, I'm no longer in Kansas. This is going to be a very, very different kind of case. And it was. And we fought extremely hard, and hard enough that at one point I thought the judge was going to hold me in contempt of court. And
I'm sure Peter intended that.
and this was at a time when we were anxious to just get ahead and challenge what they were doing. And I think the court didn't want us to go in that direction. I'm sure of it. And I think I was told that in no uncertain terms. But I came out and said to Peter and Bill Ferguson, the president of the local, I said, well, they asked me what's going to happen. I said, well, you know, if we go down this road, I could be held in contempt. And Pete said to me, Dave, don't worry about it. We'll take it to jail.
Now, you found out what it means to be a labor lawyer when you have rank-and-file leaders.
Yes, absolutely. No, he was a leader of great strength and integrity, as everyone says. Yeah. And frankly, in the Stelco case, he was proven by time to be right. Stelco thought that they could strip the union of its pension and strip the workers of their pension rights.
And scare them to death, right?
Scare them to death. I mean, one of the Stelco's lawyers told Pete and Bill Ferguson and myself and others that we were going to suffer a haircut so deep our heads would fall off. I don't think Peter and Bill ever forgot that, and it was Stelco's head that fell off at the end after 2 years, and the union secured the pensions for their members. It was a tremendous, huge victory, an historic victory.
Yeah. Now, I'm sorry, just to cut in briefly,
sure,
but, you know, David, and this is David Jacobs talking in memory of Peter Leavitt, but sitting here next to me, of course, is Mike Hirsch, and I like this story because of the continuity of two young men who decided that they wanted to give their talent and their intelligence and their courage to see what they could do in the labor movement, and here he was, a 50-some-odd-year-old man saying to the biggest steel company, hey, you're wrong and I'm right. Oh, we're right. Pardon me. I correct that. We are right and you are wrong. He's living out the intention.
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
As he always did.
Yeah, it's just fantastic.
I think by the end of the day, by the way, I think it's fair to say this, that he gained the respect of everybody who worked with him. He gained the respect, I'm sure, of the opposing lawyers and definitely of the judge throughout the case and of everybody who worked with him.
Yeah.
He took an extremely bold stand, and as I say, his courage gave me courage and rubbed off.
Yeah, and his fellow executive members there, like the man's name, I think it's, I call him Fergie, but it's Ferguson.
Bill Ferguson and Mark Talbot,
Bill
Vice
Ferguson,
President.
Bill Ferguson, Mark Talbot.
Rick Preston, I guess, was involved.
Rick Preston was involved.
A tough group.
But they also, you know, it gave a lot of support and courage to all the other locals that were in the midst of this, because you had Paul Perot and Dave Willis out at Alta Steel, and everybody was watching this. Rolf Gerstenberger from 1005 and Gary Howard.
Another
Vice
tough
President.
Character.
These are tough guys. These are tough locals. This is not a joke. These are tough locals, and I got to tell you, they were. Everybody was shaking in their boots. No, you know.
Well, you understood it was a little bit dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you're up against also the dominant media, and they're all writing editorials that Stelco has explained to us children, and now we all have to go along. And that's where you have a parting of the ways. And maybe that's one of the things that prompted Peter to get into alternative radio because, you know, it was raining negative opinion.
Plus, I might add, I won't mention names, but there were leaders in higher places than Peter who were counseling all the locals to give in.
Yeah, that will happen.
Yeah,
you have differences. Any time when you say, hey, I think the bad guy with the stick is coming our way, there's different opinions about how to handle that.
Well, there were certainly different opinions as to whether we should go forward and face contempt charges. But
yeah.
I've got to tell you, it's another tribute to Pete that he was able to be part of and hold together a really remarkable leadership group down at at Lake Erie, and who managed to be reelected and reelected and reelected time and time and time again.
It's hard to beat an honest man.
Yes, that's right. That's right. The other thing is, I mean, during that 2 years of an incredible struggle, he was part of keeping everyone together. We lived, we sort of went on the blankets, as they said in The Godfather. We were living together 24/7 for 2 years, basically. And he held it together with good humor and good strategy. And, it was a hard struggle, and it was a good time, frankly.
Yeah, wonderful. David, thank you for these memories. We believe we're going to be talking to Sid Ryan, president of the OFL, I think for the break, we will listen to a song, which I hope you are familiar with, called "Which Side Are You On?" And it is produced by, among others, Michael Hirsch. We'll talk to you a little later about that, Mike. But we'll listen to that, and then we hope we'll be talking to Sid Ryan. And we're back. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me in the studio is Phil Conlon, who is with SEIU, I believe, and sometimes used to be steelworkers. Jacob Leibovich, son of Peter Leibovich, and Mike Hirsch of the United Steelworkers. And I think we are joined by the president of the Ontario Federation of Labor and good friend of Peter Leibovich, Sid Ryan. Are you there, sir?
I am here. Yes, mate.
Sid, thank you very much for joining us. We, of course, want to know, like everybody else, I assume you're shocked by the death of an outstanding guy. Could you tell us your memories of him and what you think maybe the lessons are of the life of Peter Leibovich?
Well, Peter was just a beautiful man all the way around. He had a heart of gold in terms of empathy for those who are less well off or those who are politically disadvantaged or economically disadvantaged. He worked tirelessly to that end all the time. Like he never kept his eye off what I call off the donut. He always understood what he was about in life, and there was a common theme. Equity was always at the heart of it. Whether it be working, the first time I met him, well, not the first time I met him, but the first time I worked closely with him was in Scarborough Centre in 1999. Where he managed my campaign for the NDP and opened up a whole new arena, if you will, for the NDP in terms of reaching out to the Somalian community, the Sri Lankan community, the Muslim community. My campaign was just one big, massive, multicultural campaign. And at the center of that was Peter Leibovich. If it wasn't for his connections and his credibility with those communities, we just wouldn't have had the campaign we had.
Yeah.
So that's been the hallmark of his career in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he spent a tremendous amount of time bravely working on behalf of the Palestinian movement. He took a lot of heat. He was Jewish by faith himself, and he took a lot of heat from the Jewish community for speaking out in a very thoughtful way about what was happening in Palestine and the occupied territories. So, for me, at least, he was just an all-round trade unionist and social justice activist. I mean, the last, I only met him about 3 weeks ago, and he was concerned about precarious workers, whether it be home care workers or people working in the hotel industry or working on construction, migrant workers. And, of course, very much concerned about trying to organize and pioneer new ways of mobilizing, organizing taxi drivers.
Mm-hmm.
His mind was just working 24/7. I mean, this guy never stopped thinking about social justice and, issues that impacted upon working people, working class people, continually.
Yeah. Right. This is Sid Ryan. I think you and he both shared some quality, but one of them that struck me is that he had a complex and controversial opinions and knowledge, and yet he could deal with any kind of person, and they always went away thinking, I got a fair shake, and I think I understand that man.
Oh, Peter did it a lot better than I did. I'm still learning how to accomplish that. Believe
I confess Peter, to the same problem.
Peter mastered it, there's no question. Peter was able to tell you in a very nice way that you're on the wrong side of an issue, but also at the same time still remain your friend.
Yes.
He had that ability, and he never kicked off any one group over the other. He always managed to find the compromise, and he understood the art of compromise. He understood how you may not make the monumental, gigantic step you want to make in one fell swoop. Peter would essentially do it bit by bit, piece by piece, and eventually manage to move the union movement or move his own union or move the community into a progressive position. And he always found what the progressive position was always a step forward. He never took a step back. He was always moving forward, but but very slowly, methodically, he worked his way through problems and built a tremendous amount of respect because of his ability to be able to do that.
Yeah. Now, of course, the OFL has got great battles ahead of it. I hope that I'm sure is going to resonate. I hope that everybody will just become a little bit stronger from knowing Pete.
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, I was relying a lot upon Peter, too, you know, because I've got part of my platform that I ran on was to open up the labor movement and make it more inclusive and bring in more people of color and equality to the labor movement. And Peter was, you know, factoring in a big part of that in using his contacts to reach out and start to build the base at the bottom and be more inclusive.
Yeah.
He and I shared a vision that we know that the next generation of leaders in the labor movement are going to come from the visible minority communities and people who are, you know, coming into this country maybe only today will be the leaders of this labor movement at some point down the road. And trying to prepare the way and pave the way for that to happen was part of Peter's vision and is also part of mine. So it's a tragic loss. But also, too, you know, as a personal friend, Peter was somebody you could phone up and you know, talk through the problems that you were encountering, whether it be in the labor movement or elsewhere. And he was a good friend that way. He was just a beautiful person.
Yeah. Well, and by the way, I understand you're going to be intend to be at the meeting Sunday. There could be a memorial meeting. You intend to be there.
Oh, absolutely. I wouldn't miss it. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Sid Ryan, President of the OFL, we're really grateful for your sharing your memories about Peter, and we look forward to seeing that vision that you and he projected going to success.
I certainly hope I can live up to it and live up to Peter's vision too. But it's a pleasure I've been able to share my thoughts. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Okay, thank you. Bye bye.
Sid Ryan, president of the OFL, and boy, that was a very telling account. I mean, incidentally, now with saying further, we're speaking of course, the memory of Peter Leibovitz, who unfortunately very recently lost, and that's why it's rather poignant, and all of us, I think we're still also semi-shocked. But one thing I guess, are not shocked by is that the unanimity of the language, the consensus in language to describe Peter. You know, it's not just, well, he was a leader or he was combative. Or, no. People understood him, his character. And without character, you're a dead duck. And he had plenty. Now, we had a message from an old friend of his in Caracas, Venezuela. By the way, we've also had a message from an outstanding labor leader in New Zealand who works in health and safety in Beijing, China. And he's been sending messages and worrying about Peter. We have, you know, Peter was in the Philippines. It's amazing where this guy got to and how the success he had. And Jacob, I think you have with you a message from a friend of his in Caracas.
Yeah. You know, his name is Roberto San Vicente. Mike Hirsch mentioned him earlier as somebody who met my father at the same time as Mike, and obviously they became activists together. And he sent this note when he had found out my father was sick, but before he knew that he'd passed away. But I think it sort of speaks to that. The point that folks who got to work with him and got to know him.
Now this is, again, someone who knew him in the late 60s,
68.
You know, him being more than just someone they happened to work with at some point. So it begins to Jacob, his brothers and sisters. Peter was my friend, but more than a friend, he was my comrade. I don't know how often we use that expression today and what it means nowadays. Then I knew what it meant. 1968, 1969, 1970 onwards. It meant something at least or closer than a brother. It was a dimension of trust, of faith, of confidence, of worthiness, of conviction, of compromise, of sacrifice, of affection, of everything you could share with a human being. Peter meant all that to me. Therefore, with deep sorrow, I received the news of his illness, because when Peter goes, part of me will also leave. My only consolation will be the remembrance of his courage and great commitment in his beliefs. We shared great endeavors. We walked the same path and came to the same crossroads, joined in battles for the cause of the redemption of man from exploitation and oppression. May the memory of Comrade Peter live forever.
That's Roberto San Vicente Caracas, Venezuela, where many struggles are being waged, and in which one of the great confrontations between an empire and a southern nation is going on. We're going to be trying to reach, I think, Tina Conlon, who, that's your wife, Philip, and she, and Tina, oh, she's already on the line. Are you there, Tina?
Yes, I am.
I'm sorry, I thought we were awaiting you. The you knew Peter, of course, very well, but you know, as a member of the Filipino Philippine community, he recently made a trip there, which was not entirely safe, by the way.
No.
Because you come from a pretty dangerous country. Tell what was he doing there, and what's your thoughts about, particularly in reference to the Philippine community and Peter?
Well, I was really very happy when I got that email from Peter saying that he was going to the Philippines. And for the 25 years that I've met him, I know that we've talked about what's going on in the Philippines, and we know about the conditions that workers have there, as well as the condition economically there that necessitated them having to go elsewhere to find labor or to find means to sustain themselves. And, of course, we have a lot of Filipinos who are migrant workers. Either they're working on domestic unorganized labor or also unorganized farm labor in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter really made it a point of being there, and I was so happy because Peter was a person that was very clear whenever he was talking about anything that have to do with labor rights, but also he tied that in also with those people who have not been able to organize themselves due to a variety of reasons, and recognize that the systems that put them there are very similar to what's going on in here.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just telling Philip, my husband there, that I was wondering whether when Peter was in the Philippines, whether he was offered to taste a cashew fruit. And I'm not sure whether you're familiar, but a cashew fruit. I know you're familiar with a cashew nut.
Tell us.
A cashew fruit, the cashew is a strange fruit because the nut actually sits on top of it, like a princess sitting on top of a mm-hmm. of a cup. But the cashew fruit, while it's edible, and it's actually a very delicious fruit, tastes of sort of like a mango, guava, and a pear, and it's very sweet, it's also very astringent. And it's the kind of fruit that you eat after you've eaten too many rich foods. You know, like you've had too much of too many rich food. And so this is what your mother would give to you to kind of cleanse your palate and make you pucker up and you lose your desire to eat anymore. And to me, that was what Peter was like. He was an astringent person. He was able to cut through the fat. He spoke with such an astringency that clarified issues, and it helped others know where to stand just by listening to him. And it takes away all the fancy things, and he's just able to see where things are. And as a Filipino immigrant, having met Peter and knowing that, my goodness, the value of what he could provide the Filipino community here is just incredible. And it was very quick. Soon after he's made that trip, he was able to get a lot of the migrant workers organized, and they started rallying around and having hope that there's an ability to organize where they weren't able to organize before. And so there was hope in the kind of contributions that Peter made. And I know I'm bouncing all over the place here, but
we all
feel
are.
Very, very sad about what's happening. It's something that it's a great loss. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, I think about the contributions he's made, and that has stayed on. And on top of also being a Filipino, I'm also a very religious person. And it's something that I was also able to share with him. And he never once made me feel that my being religious is something contrary to how I could contribute to having a concern for others and the working person. And that's the kind of thing that I really appreciated what Peter was able to help me.
Tina, that's a very thoughtful, a very important. Everybody here is very touched by that. We're sure glad you shared that, and we are confident. You know, the person you described and the work he was doing is going to be carried on, because he didn't make all this effort for naught. And you're a living testimony. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
We always miss seeing you down here, by the way.
I hope so. And again, my love and my thoughts to Jacob and the family and everyone else.
Thank you,
Tina.
Thank you.
We hope we see you Sunday.
Yes.
Bye. Okay. Bye-bye. That's Tina Conlon, and she is, of course, part of our little broadcast collective on Alternative Radio, CIUT. That's what you're listening to, 89.5 FM, and it's a Taylor Report. By the way, all of our previous broadcasts, including interviews with Peter, can be accessed on our website, taylor-report.com. And also, you should go to the station in Hamilton and Jacob. It's called
Unusual Sources.
Unusual Sources.
On CFMU.
And CF?
CFMU is the caller.
CFMU. He did a weekly broadcast mainly focused on, I shouldn't say mainly, but often focused on labor. His big passion at the moment of his passing was a fight for taxi drivers. And by the way, now, Phil, you have a message, too, that was sent by the Canadian Air Federation.
Yes.
Could you read that?
Yes, I'm going to read a message. The passing away of activist Peter Leibovich. With great sadness and deepest sorrow, we received the news of the passing away of Peter Leibovich. Peter was a brave activist against war and occupation, a tireless advocate for peace and social justice issues, a committed trade unionist, and an NDP builder and organizer. Peter did not shy away from tackling tough issues, and he was always willing to stand up, be counted, and take on the establishment. Peter defended the rights of the Palestinian people and supported their just struggle for freedom and equality, and spoke at events organized to condemn Israel's aggression against Lebanon in the summer of 2006 and its criminal assault on Gaza in 2009. No words can describe Peter's legacy and commitment. Everyone who knew Peter and worked with him on the many campaigns will remember for a long time all the great things Peter has done. We at the Canadian Arab Federation, Palestine House, York Islamic Center, and Canadian Shia Muslims Organization extend our deepest sympathy to Peter's family and stand with them in this difficult period. And this is a press release from the Canadian Arab Federation dated September 19th.
There are other, just to share, thank you very much, Phil. That was Phil Conlon. And there has been a comment which people have been very touched by Michael Corrin. Peter used to appear on the Michael Corrin program, as did Sid Ryan. It's a tribute to the integrity and I'd say guts of Michael Corrin that he had Peter and Sid and respected both of them. He issued quite a good statement about appreciation of the integrity, courage, and talent of Peter Leibovich. In the time remaining, I was something we might discuss here, memories, but we, Mike, you and I saw Peter shortly before he began his undertake his treatment, which, of course, proved to be basically incapacitated him, and we lost our ability to communicate with him. But it was like a scene from Waiting for Lefty. There's a great American play by Clifford Odets. It's probably the greatest play of the 1930s and certainly one of the emblematic stories about organizing. And it's a story that is built around a meeting of taxi drivers who are being organized. And, of course, they have all the classic. You have the owner, and then you have some people who are not entirely sincere who claim to be union people. And then you have the rank and file, and then you have Lefty and some others. And the way the play was staged, They put the actors, some of them in the audience, Clifford Odets put them in the audience, and so someone who was chairing the meeting in the play would say something, and this member would stand up in the audience and say, "You're selling us out, you're lying to us, and what have you done to Lefty, et cetera." I felt when we went over to see Peter, my goodness, he's lying on the fourth floor in terrible condition, confronting the worst battle of his life alone. And downstairs, there were taxi drivers gathering in great numbers and coming and going and being of help to his family and friends. And all of them treated it as appropriately as they were privileged and glad to be doing it. But it was to come out of my last conversation where, by the way, I hope we said the right things. We said, what would you like? What can we do? On the assumption that he was going to get well. And so what do you want us, while you're getting well, tell us what you want. And, of course, the taxi drivers were on his mind. Of course, he also shared in good humor all the latest headlines of, you know, what one leader in the world was saying about another leader. And he was bemused, as usual, by that, and hungry for information, as usual. But to go downstairs and to find taxi drivers ready to meet and talk, and immediately grabbed onto Mike because he was subbing for Peter Leibich, but it was like Waiting for Lefty. And I have to tell you that the play, Waiting for Lefty, is a great success. The meetings go on. The struggles are intellectual but passionate. And at the end of the play, they're examining the false leader who has let them down, and they're asking about Lefty. And the news comes that Lefty's been shot. He won't be returning. He's not going to be at the meeting. And then they put questions about what shall we do? And they vote to strike. And when they do, in the play, the people who paid their money and come to watch all stand up and yell, strike. Not because anybody told them, but because they think they're participating in a vote. Anyway, I thought, my goodness, I feel like I'm in the middle of a play, how appropriate. Clifford Odets, one of the great literary figures, and, of course, one of the great leftist figures and great progressive figures in American art, and absolutely remarkable. The film Barton Fink was based roughly on him. It wasn't entirely complimentary, but Hollywood never gets it right, but it shows the impact of the man, and he won't even scrub away the great play called Waiting for Lefty, and of course, neither will you scrub away the work of Peter Leibich, but it just it embodies it. And I got to ask Mike, because I want to make sure people know about this too, that you, and Peter is one of the people who encouraged you, I'm sure, produced this collection of Union songs.
Yeah, you actually played one of the songs, Which Side Are You On, which is it was unionist singing it. That particular song was Marnie Niemi, from who's a staff rep with OPSU. The CD is a CD of karaoke songs. It's a wonderful collection, and it was produced by Brian Didier, Tony Lear from the CAW, myself from Steel. It was funded by the National Office of the Steelworkers, Kenny Newman.
Great credit to them.
Yeah, I mean it's a And it's been very popular. It's played on radio stations, really alternative stations.
You know, I went to a meeting of to Steelworker Hall, and Kenny Newman was there as the chairman, and they were calling for the freedom of the Cuban Five, and the president emeritus of SEIU was there. The head of the British Union Unite was there. And it really is a tribute to the union movement, the health of it at this time. In particular, I say congratulate the steelworkers that occurred. And I do recall Peter was not able to make that. And I remember calling him and saying, "Are you aware of this?" And he said, "Hooray!" I mean, he was very pleased. Phil, you were going to say, I think I haven't given you an opportunity actually to share.
Yeah, and you know, there is a lot of memories I'd like to talk about, Peter, and I guess we'll come back to it next week.
Incidentally, obviously, Which, this is a mini-volume story. We will tell it.
But there is one story that I just think is so extraordinary. There was, for the left, there are easy issues and difficult issues. And I don't think in my life of living in Ontario for 40 years, I've seen a more difficult one. Was the issue in 1984 when the Ontario government, under a conservative government, decided to extend the funding for the Catholic schools, which are, of course, guaranteed in the Canadian Constitution, but for some reason only went up through grade 10, so and the Catholic community, therefore, couldn't have their high schools without having to pay out of the pocket. It was a very divisive issue on the left, and there were certain people on the left who made it even more divisive because of, you know, the way they behave. If there was one person who really stood forward and figured it out, looked at the whole history of Ontario, the context in which this constitutional guarantee existed, who in the Ontario community benefited from this constitutional protection, it was Peter Leibovitz. And here you have Peter Leibovitz, you know, about whom all kinds of awful things have been said in the past, running around Hamilton with a very, very left-wing Presbyterian minister, as I remember, who understood the historical prejudice against Roman Catholics in Ontario, with all kinds of leaders in the Roman Catholic community who would never have ever thought they'd be on a platform with a left-wing person. But there they were. And Peter was the most eloquent defender of the rights of the Catholic community, and therefore the defender of the right of the decision taken by a kind of a right-wing government. It was a very, very difficult political task, and a lot of people, frankly, stumbled and fell on it because they couldn't figure it out. And man, Peter got it right. He got it right from day one, and he really carried the ball on it.
Well, and also against the difficult current. Incidentally, yeah. I mean, when you speak of Peter's qualities, yeah. You have to appreciate. You see. The beauty of the man was that if he had been wrong, he would have still been doing it in earnest and for unity, and so he was going to resonate. His opinion is going to resonate through it. Completely remarkable. We got to better tell people. You've been listening to Phil Conlon, Jacob Leibovitz, Mike Hirsch, and myself, Phil Taylor, the Sunday there's going to be a meeting. Stony Creek.
Yeah, it's the address is in Stony Creek. It's a place called Leuna Gardens, and for folks who know it. It's at 526 Winona Road North, and we really would like everyone to come and hear about his life.
Yeah. Well, for the Taylor Report, this is Phil Taylor. We'll be with you next week.